prepared to take the annual yard picks here from Greeks. Given by Professor Lewis Feldman, topic this afternoon's talk is why were the Maccabees opposed to the Greek religion and culture? Professor Lewis Feldman has been teaching at Yeshiva University. This is now his 50th year of teaching. Graduated from Harvard University, the author and editor of over 16 books, over 138 articles, he's a teacher to many of Yeshiva's graduates, including Professor David Berger, Brooklyn College, Professor Shaya Cohen of Harvard University, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, the chief rabbi of Efrat. A few issues ago, I'm the commentator of a special article in honor of Professor Feldman's 50th year of teaching. We will be making a recording of this talk and after that, Professor Lewis Feldman about why were the Maccabees opposed to Greek religion and culture. The annual yard pitch here.
Thank you very much. I'm usually introduced as professor of Latin and Greek, but those who have studied with me refer to me as professor of Latin and Greek. My topic, why were the Maccabees opposed to Greek culture, Greek religion and culture? After all, what was wrong with the Greek religion? It was liberal, it was pluralistic. And so far as culture is concerned, if the Nobel Prizes had been awarded in those days, they would be won by the Greeks. In the 5th century BCE, the only prominent Jew, I think, would be Ezra, perhaps. But so far as the Greeks are concerned, they produced a whole host of great figures. In fact, you might look at it this way. The various aspects of culture, what we call culture, the name is Greek and the thing is Greek. For example, philosophy, Greek word, Greek thing. Physics, Greek word, Greek thing. Biology, mathematics, astronomy, history, tragedy, comedy, epic, rhetoric, politics, economics. They're all Greek. The Greek thing, they were the ones who defined the issues, the parameters were all defined by the Greeks. So what is it that we should be afraid of, or that we should rebel against? Now, you know, there is one person in the Talmudic literature who actually was so enamored of what is called Greek song, Zemer Yevani, that was Elisha ben Avuya, Acher, that he was led astray. There's a great deal of discussion amongst the commentators as to what this Greek song was. My own opinion is that since poetry was sung, it probably was Homer, because that was the great author, the one that was, for practical purposes, the Bible of the Greeks, and he was presumably misled by Homer. Homer, as you know, Siphle Homeros, the only expression in the entire Yama Talmud, actually in the Mishnah and Yudayim, referring to a Greek author, is that one, the books of Homer. And presumably he was misled by what Homer himself had said. And I thought that I would start, in order to be fair about it, I thought that I would give you perhaps some passages from, well, what you're familiar with, of course, from Jewish literature, and some from Greek literature, and then tell me what is the difference between them. Now, first I'll start, naturally I'll start with the Jewish literature. Now, this particular passage is familiar to you. Often, even a whole city suffers for a bad man who sins and devises presumptuous deeds. You know where that comes from? Any of you? Well, you don't know because it's not from, you thought it would be from Jewish literature, but it actually comes from Hesiod. It comes from a Greek poet who was a younger contemporary of Homer. And this is what he writes. The whole city suffers for a bad man who sins. He talks about being punished for sinning. Another passage which I'll give you. This one you'll certainly recognize because it certainly is something familiar to you. For with ease doth he make strong, and with ease doth he bring strong men low, and with ease doth he humble the proud, and with ease doth he raise the obscure, and with ease doth he straighten the crooked, and humbles the proud. From Philip? No. Again, it's from Hesiod. From Hesiod. I'll give you another passage, this time from a 3rd century BCE Stoic writer named Cleanthes. Incidentally, this is an author that you really should read. Have any of you read the works of him, Cleanthes? Of course, the answer is you couldn't have because his work is lost. But we have a fragment. We have a fragment. Now, here's a fragment. God omnipotent, through endless years the same, we are thy children. Chaos to thee is order. Thou art universal law. Thou art righteous. Where did that come from? It comes from a Greek philosopher of the 3rd century BCE. But of course, the author who was most influential, there's no question about it, is Homer. So I'm going to quote for you a passage from Homer, and I'm going to quote for you a passage which probably reflects Homer's own thinking. Why do I say that? Because it's from a simile. You know what a simile is? It's a comparison. And the author really doesn't have to bring it in. But if he does, he's probably bringing in his own ideas. Now here's the passage. It comes from the 16th book of the Iliad. Even as beneath a tempest, the whole black earth is oppressed on an autumn day, when God pours forth rain most vehemently, being in wrath and anger against men who judge crooked judgments forcefully in the assembly, and drive justice out, and reck not of vengeance of God. Now these people are going to be punished because they're unjust. And all their rivers run full, and many a hillside the torrents tear away, and down to the dark sea they rush headlong from the hills, roaring mightily. The whole idea of this passage is that there is reward and there is punishment for just and unjust deeds. Now you may say, well, maybe these are scattered, isolated passages. But the fact is that as early as the 6th century BCE, Pythagoras, the philosopher, we all know the Pythagorean theorem. Pythagoras, again, you should really read what he has to say, but his work happens to be lost. However, we have again a fragment, and it shows you that there were some people, and I see some people would say, well, after all, the Greeks had, you know, all these gods and so on that didn't behave properly and so on. But the fact of the matter is that here's Pythagoras who criticizes his own religion. When Pythagoras visited Hades, in other words, after he died, his own beast, he saw Homer and Hesiod, these are the two great poets who have infected the Bible of the Greeks, enduring the punishment of the damned for what they had said about the gods. In other words, if you read Homer and Hesiod, you'll see that they are critical. They say some things, and in general, they, of course, seem to be praising the gods. So Pythagoras is punished because he says that Homer and Hesiod are punished because of what they said against the gods. So apparently he didn't agree with Homer and Hesiod. And here's another one, Xenophanes, around 500 BCE. Now again, we haven't read him because his work is lost, but we have fragments. And he says the following: Homer and Hesiod assign to the gods all that is disgraceful and blameworthy among men, stealing and adultery and mutual deceit. So he's critical of the religions. So the Greeks then did produce people who were in disagreement with their own religion, apparently. Heraclitus, philosopher around 500 BCE. Again, you probably haven't read his work, it is lost. Homer deserves to be chased out of the lists and beaten up with rods because, again, he misrepresented the gods as being irreverent, being immoral, and so on. And of course, Plato in the Republic is critical of the religion, and when he outlines his ideal state, he outlines a state in which there's going to be an education starting from the very, very young years, and the question is, what will be included? So he says, well, obviously you'll start with Homer and Hesiod. Then he says, how can you? Homer and Hesiod represent the gods as being immoral. So there are people, obviously, who disagree. There's a statement in Stendhal's Anachrones in which he says, and this is, again, a poet living about 500 BCE, he says that if horses had gods, they would look like horses. The Ethiopians have gods that are black-nosed and snub-nosed and black. Yeah. So in other words, there were people who criticized the representations of gods. After all, they're anthropomorphic. They're like human beings. So I then come to the question, if this is so, so what is really so to be condemned in the Greek religion? After all, there were different opinions already expressed even at a fairly early time. And I might say parenthetically that if Plato disagreed with Homer and Hesiod to the point where he excluded them from the educational system, and Plato was the most influential thinker, there's no question about it, during the Hellenistic period. Plato died around 347 BCE, and his works were extremely influential, more influential by far than Aristotle, incidentally. So if he was critical of the religion, why should we be so critical? Now, Plato lived long before the time of the Maccabees. Maccabees is 2nd century BCE. So what then should we say the Maccabees and people who agreed with them found impossible to accept in the Greek religion? I think that one thing that we should note is that in the Greek, first of all, there's more than one Greek religion. It is really wrong to speak of the Greek religion. There was the Olympian religion, which consisted of the 12 major divinities, and then there were many, many more divinities, minor divinities. But then there was also the Orphic religion. Now, I don't know whether any of you have read the Orphic Bible. Have any of you read that? That's lost too. But the fact is that, again, we have planets. So we know what they had. It was a different kind of religion. Then there were, of course, the mystery cults, like the Eleusinian mysteries and so on. So there were many, many religions among the Greeks. The question is, why should there be a condemnation of all the Greek religion? Why not simply say that we disagree with this religion or that religion or this aspect or that aspect? Now, the answer that I would suggest is this, that the Greeks had not only a religion deep in gods, they also had a religion in a belief of powers beyond the gods. These are the fates. And the gods themselves are subject to the fates. So that, for example, in Homer, when Zeus wants to rescue his son, Sarpedon, and he can do it, but his wife, Hera, says, if you do it, then we may do it, and there'll be no end to it. So he doesn't rescue his own son. Or when he tried to rescue Hector, who had offered him many sacrifices, very pious Trojans and so on, he doesn't do it, even though he could do it. Why? Because the fates already had declared that Hector had to die. So there was a religion then beyond the gods, and that was what, in effect, the gods were subject to, a realm beyond divinity. And one other thing which we should bear in mind, the Rambam, when he tries to give proofs for the existence of God, in the Lord's book here, declines to give the most obvious proof for the existence of God. And what is that? The proof from creation. In other words, there is a world. How did the world get here? There must have been some force, some being that created the world. Therefore, there is God. Never says that. Why doesn't he say that? Because he wanted to present proofs that would be acceptable even to philosophers. When he says philosophers, of course, he's thinking of Aristotle, the Aristotelians. Because by that time, in the 12th century, you realize the Aristotelians had won the day among the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians. And according to Aristotle, you don't have the world created. The world is always here. And Aristotle, like all the Greeks, identified the world with God, with gods. Nature equals the world. So once you say that the world is nature, then in effect, you can't have anything that a Jew can accept. We have the view that God created the world. And that's the most important part, you might say, of the whole Torah, even, the very beginning, certainly. So once you don't have that, then you can't accept the Greek point of view, which identifies God or gods with nature. However, there is a more particular reason why the Maccabees or the Hashmonaim could not accept the religion that was being foisted upon them by Antiochus. Of course, I might say parenthetically that you realize that my information does not come from any of the books of Tanakh. It doesn't come, incidentally, from the Yama Talmud, because there's almost nothing beyond my Hanukkah. There's almost nothing there. So therefore, I am dependent upon the books of Maccabees, which are in the Apocrypha. And it's ironic, incidentally, that these books are part of the Bible of Christians, not all Christians, but many Christians. And it's ironic, incidentally, that the word Hanukkah, which is not, of course, mentioned in Tanakh, is found in the Gospels. The word Hanukkah is found in the Gospels. And there is, incidentally, a feast day for the Maccabees, the 1st of August in the Christian church. It's really ironic. But maybe I'll come back to that, because I want to come now to the next point. And that is precisely what kind of religion was being forced upon the Jews in that day, in the 2nd century BCE. Now, according to the first book of Maccabees, when the festival of Dionysus took place, the Jews were compelled to march in the procession for Dionysus, garlanded with ivy wreaths. So in other words, what he was trying to produce, but trying to impose upon the Jews, was their participation in the festival of Dionysus. Now Dionysus, who is Dionysus? Dionysus is one of the 12 important gods of the Olympian system. Now, very important to bear in mind who he was. According to the Greeks, he was the son of Zeus and Semele. Now, you've all heard of Semele. You know what Semele is? No, you don't. Semele is the daughter of Cadmus, the Phoenician. In other words, Semele is a Semite. Interesting. Dionysus is the son of a Semitic mother. And very interesting, he's the son of a divine father and a human mother. Now, you'll see in a moment why I keep emphasizing that. They want the Greeks want to emphasize that the gap between divinity and mortality is really not great at all, because one of our boys, so to speak, made it. Now, that sounds a little familiar, especially this season of the year. What I'm driving at, and I'm not saying that simply to be clever. I mean, there is, I think, a connection here between the Dionysiac religion and Christianity, which later emerged. In fact, you'll see what I'll make the point later is that Christianity, which triumphed not long after all these events, triumphed because the groundwork had been laid by this type of religion. And Christianity, which, as you know, is paganism with a slight veneer of Judaism, Christianity is very close, actually, to the worship of Dionysus, and we'll see in a moment how. Now, Dionysus, then, was the son of a mortal woman and a divine father. Now, do any of you happen to know how Christmas Eve is referred to in German? Any of you know? Weihnacht. Weihnacht. W-E-I-H-N-A-C-H-T. Weihnacht. Now, Weihnacht means the night of dedication. Does that ring a bell? Chanukah Habayit. They were translating. See, maybe I shouldn't digress, as I always do. But Christianity decided somewhere around the 4th century, but not early, decided that Yeshua Nasri was born on December 25th. Why pick on December 25th? There's no reference whatsoever in the Gospels as to when he was born. But the fact of the matter is that the people who decided on December 25th decided that way because there was a Roman festival known as the Saturnalia, which began on December 25th and lasted incidentally for 7 days and had certain peculiar customs. For example, that slaves were giving orders to masters, that gifts were exchanged, that there was gambling. Now, it sounds a little bit familiar, but what I'm saying is that this is the sort of thing which the Christians picked up, and they picked up largely from the worship of Dionysus. Now, the worship of Dionysus was associated with wild plants such as ivy. And that is why I always tell people they should not go to an Ivy League school. The fact is that this is really a bodhisattva, the worst sort. They used to get high. In fact, if you take a look at the play by Euripides called the Bacchae, you'll see that he has there a case where Dionysus is coming into the city of Thebes, and he's welcomed by the mother of the king, the king opposes him, and the net result is the mother becomes high. He got ecstatic. You know what ecstatic means? It's a Greek word. It means getting outside of yourself. She gets ecstatic, and when they get ecstatic in the worship of Dionysus, they grab animals and they drink their blood and they eat the flesh. Sound a little familiar? So like holy communion. So this is what the mother of Pentheus, the king of Thebes, did when Dionysus came into town. Eventually, after she came to, she realized that she made a mistake. She had not done this to an animal, she's done it to her own son. Well, sometimes people make mistakes too. But what I'm saying is that this is the worship of Dionysus. You get ecstatic, literally. You get high. In fact, you know the word enthusiasm is the Greek word, entheos. You get God in you. Now you see, why did they do this? Why did Agave, the mother of Pentheus, eat this animal thinking this is Dionysus, She's eating the God and she's drinking his blood. Why? Because she thought that if she ate the God and drank his blood, she'd become divine. That was the one thing that they wanted very, very much to do. A human being should become a God. And it was possible. They thought it was possible. There were cases in point. I mean, incidentally, you all know the story of Hercules, right? Hercules was also one of these people who had a divine parent and a human parent, and he died, but eventually he became a god also. It's possible. You see, they thought that it was possible for a person to be born of a human parent and to become a god as well. And this is the way that the Dionysiac worship continued. It was in this form of this ritual. I want to comment now, and you see, if what I've said is, I think, correct, namely that this is a form that is very similar to Christianity in terms of its theory, right? That you have a Holy Communion kind of thing, you get ecstatic, you carry it out of yourself, become another person. You can become God, so to speak. If this is so, and then if indeed the worship of Dionysus was of this sort, then it's a sort of pre-Christianity. Now, I'm going to be teaching a course during the coming term on Roman civilization. And on the final exam, I usually ask, how do you explain that the Christians were able to triumph? But the truth is that if the Christians were able to triumph, the fact is that they didn't really triumph. They simply took paganism and they added a little bit of a twist, you might say, of Judaism to it. So that here, by having Antiochus get the Jews to adopt this particular religion, this in effect laid the groundwork for Christianity, and Christianity was able to triumph, and the Jews were able to resist. Now, why were the Jews able to resist? Because they turned this particular religion down. It's like taking, it's like being inoculated. They've been inoculated with a certain, a small taste. When you're inoculated, you have a small taste of the disease. So that's it. They had a small taste of it during this Greek period in the 2nd century BCE. And then when Christianity came, the real thing, so to speak, came, they were able to turn it down. As you know, in the entire downtown woods, we have the names of thousands of rabbis. How many of those rabbis were converted to Christianity? Zero. Not a single one. And I think one reason is because they already had been experiencing. They had already been exposed to this kind of religion where, in effect, a man becomes God and you can eat the God and drink the God's wine. Incidentally, you know, in the 2nd century CE, there was a Roman named Pliny the Younger who was a governor of Bithynia. And he writes to the Emperor Trajan, he says, what am I supposed to do with these crazy people? They call themselves Christians. They're cannibals. They're cannibals. They eat gods. They eat God, they drink God. That's what we could mean. And so Trajan says to them, leave them alone, don't bother with them. And then we should go ahead. But the fact of the matter is, I'm saying that this type of religion is precisely what you had here and was the type of religion which was now about to be imposed and was actually imposed, at least tried to be imposed, by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I want to say one other thing about Dionysus, which again will show you the connection with Christianity and why Jews should oppose him. The story is that, you know the story of Theseus and Ariadne, right? Now, Theseus was this hero, this Athenian hero, who, you remember, killed a Minotaur with the help of this woman named Ariadne, the princess, the daughter of Minos, the king of Crete. And then she falls in love. She had fallen in love with him, helps him out. And then they elope, then they come to this island of Naxos, and he says, thank you very much, goodbye. Just jokes her. Right? And then it turns out, according to the story, that Dionysus is the one who took up with this Ariadne. Again, Dionysus, the god who took up with this human being named Ariadne. And then we find that Theseus is very jealous and arranges to have Dionysus killed, according to one version. Killed? What do you mean? How is it possible for a god to be killed? So the answer is, from their point of view, a god can be killed, it doesn't stay dead. He can be resurrected. What do you mean, resurrected? Again, that's Christianity. The idea, you realize that at Delphi, the Greeks would point to the tomb of Dionysus. Now, how can you have the tomb of a god? But that's it. Their notion was that gods are like human beings, so therefore they could die just as much. Now, one other aspect of the Dionysiac worship, which I want to call upon to understand, it was a forerunner of women's liberation. Now, in what sense? The women in Greece were not only oppressed, but if you read, for example, the second book of the history of Peloponnesian War by Thucydides, you see that at the end of the funeral oration, he finally says a word about the women. The best thing you can do is be quiet. Now, the fact is that women were most crucial for the economic system, because men, of course, had to do work. They had to fight, they had to talk in the agora and so on. They're various things that take time. So, therefore, the women ran the whole system for economic purposes, at least. But the fact is that they were oppressed. Now, he became the woman's champion, so that he is called Lucius. Now, the Greek word Lucius means a liberator. He liberated the women from slavery, so to speak. So that he is the forerunner in this particular respect. Of those of you who know the Shabbatite Sea movement, the Jacob Frank movement, you realize that they also are movements which are women's liberation movements, the same sort of liberating women, etc. So he's called, therefore, a woman's liberator and a woman's god. He's also called Pseudo, which means he's a false man. I leave it to you to figure that one out. But in any case, he's also called Dendrites. Now, why is he called Dendrites? Dendrites means tree god. Why is a god called a tree? Now, have you ever wondered where the Christmas tree comes from? And this, I think, is the answer, that it is a symbol of the God, and again, this identification with Dionysus, who was a tree god. Again, Zeus wanted him to be born a girl, and he was reared as a girl, and so on. It ended up as a boy, as a god, and so on. They do things which, shall I say, are unusual. Now, Dionysus, in the name of Dionysus, and this you see in this play by Euripides, one reason why he was opposed by Pentheus, the king of Thebes, was because Dionysus taught that you had to surrender to his will completely. You had to be ready to sacrifice. You had to be ready to kill. In other words, ready to carry on a holy war. You had to be ready to cook your own children. Cook your own children, right? In the name of Dionysus, as a token of submission to him. Again, this idea of total submission to the god. This is what, in effect, was being preached by Dionysus and by the king Antiochus, in effect, as well. There was a festival known as the Anthesteria, in which the wife of the Archon Basileus, and the Archon Basileus was literally the king Archon, the chief magistrate of the city, was the wife of the king. The wife of the chief magistrate was married to Dionysus, and we know that how that particular festival was celebrated. It was a festival of ill omen. Now, how can you have a festival of ill omen? It's supposed to be a happy occasion. So the answer is that it was a festival in which the dead would ascend to the upper world. They would be resurrected. Again, Dionysus is the god that guarantees resurrection. And we hear that the people who would try to encourage these people to come from the land of the dead would chew buckthorn. I don't even know what buckthorn is. Maybe some of you do, but it's apparently some kind of drug, maybe a whole bunch of it in San Francisco. I don't know what that is. Anyway, what I'm saying is that they have to chew that in order to encourage the dead to come up, because this god Dionysus is going to resurrect the dead. There's a play by Aristophanes. Now, Aristophanes is a comedian, and he exaggerates, of course, called The Frogs. Now, in The Frogs, what happens is Dionysus, who is the god of tragedy as well as of comedy, decides that the two tragedians, the two greatest tragedians at that particular time, have just died. They died in a short time of one another, namely Sophocles and Euripides, and we have to resurrect them and get one of them to come back. So he goes to the lower world and decides, well, there are three there. Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, which one's going to be brought back? So I won't go into all the details, but the point is that Dionysus is the god who is able to resurrect the dead, bring back, in effect, even the tragedian who's already dead. He went to the lower world to bring back his own mother. His mother, after all, was immortal, right? And he's able to do that. He's a god who is able to resurrect the dead. In the Eleusinian Mysteries, he played a very important role, and he had to be invoked. Now, the way in which he was invoked was, invoke the god, he was asked. And the reply was, Inachus, son of Semele, giver of wealth. So therefore, when you were in the Eleusinian Mysteries, you were trying, in effect, to become immortal, transcend your mortality. This is what they're supposed to say. Inachus, son of Semele, giver of wealth. Now, why? Inachus is another name for Bacchus or for Dionysus. There are several names. So why refer to Dionysus as the son of Semele? Semele is a human mother. So again, that he is a god, but he is the son of a human being. I must say parenthetically that you realize that the Greeks, even virgin birth, you know what virgin birth is? Virgin birth you have among the Greeks. I mean, Hephaestus, the god Hephaestus, was born of a virgin birth, according to the usual version, born of a virgin birth. That's what the Christians picked that one up. Okay, I've said really something that to give you some idea of the religious problems that confronted any Jew who was going to do what Dionysus told them to do in the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. They couldn't do that. However, This is the Greek religion. I want to say something now about Greek thought. It's interesting, and I think this is an important point, that there's no Greek word for to sin. No Greek word for to sin. The Greek verb which is used, hamartano, is to miss the target. It's not the concept of to sin. What you do have, this is an important difference between Greek thought and Jewish thought. The Greeks understand something may be wrong, yes, but they don't have the understanding of a mitzvah, a commandment, to do something right or to avoid to do something wrong. The Greeks do not have commandments. And therefore, the only way that they can think of things is, oh, it's something wrong, so okay, it's to be corrected. But it's going to be corrected at an intellectual level. It's something that you can know, perhaps, or something that could be corrected in that sense. The Greeks can give good advice, but they don't give commandments. And they don't have thou shalt not, that sort of thing. That they do not have. What is distinctive about Judaism is that we Jews have commandments. We are told this is what you must do, this is what you must not do. When someone once said, what is the most important thing that a Jew can do? It's a very Jewish question, isn't it? What's the most important thing that a Jew can do? The most important thing that a Jew can do is what he is doing now, or what he is compelled to do. And that is something that the Greeks did not even think of, because they don't have such commandments. They don't have the idea that God is a God of justice or a God of morality. God is powerful, but they don't have the moral component of it. They don't therefore have a sense of justice in the sense that we have it. Rather, they can say it's right or it's wrong. What they do, and this is, I think, what made Plato very, very popular, is they over-intellectualize. In other words, they can say this is what justice is, but it's interesting, you go through the whole Republic, the gods play a role in the Republic, but not in the sense of what we call religion. Rather, it's in order to keep people happy, or to reward them, or to fool them, or something like that. It's sort of like Karl Marx's view. But the fact is that they don't have the idea that a god is an exemplar of justice, that you have to be just because God is just, and this is in the Imitatio Dei, the imitation of God. That they do not have. So that they don't have the sense of conscience. That is, I think, a basic difference between Judaism and the Greeks. They don't have, now you see, I'll give you one example. We have the idea of giving what we call charity. We don't call it charity, we call it a commandment. We have commandment. Like a chief of chaos. There are certain things that to tell you have to leave this for the poor and so on. The Greeks don't have such a thing. They have no such commandments. And as a result, they have somebody might perhaps do something nice for a person, but he doesn't have to do it. Not that he must do it with a commandment. Some of you may remember there was a Hands Across America. This was a number of years ago. Someone decided that all Americans should join hands, and from sea to the shining sea, you should join in this particular campaign to feed the hungry and the homeless. They set a goal of $50 million. $50 million. Well, that amount of money could be raised in one dinner at UJA. Now, the fact is that they don't have this idea that you have no alternative, that you must do it. They don't have that particular idea. But I think another thing which is lacking in the Greek system, and that is a sense of pity. Now, I'll tell you where you see this. Aristotle has a word called the Poetics, and he says the function of watching a tragedy is to be freed of unfortunate feelings. And what are the unfortunate feelings? Pity and terror. Because you see on the stage things going on, and you say, oh, there, but for the fates of God is on the ivy there. So they don't have a sense of pity. Pity is something bad, something to be gotten rid of. They don't have a sense of humility. Also, why? That's a very important point. One of my teachers at Harvard, Werner Jaeger, wrote a three-volume work called Isaiah, the Ideals of Greek Culture. And he starts in the preface by saying a very, very important statement. It is the most important thing that the Greeks did, they invented, was man. They discovered man. They discovered the possibilities of man. And those of you who are acquainted with the play Antigone by Socrates, you see the famous chorus, a lot how they know. Many other wonderful, terrible things, but none more wonderful than man. Man, they had the idea that man was so great, so heavy, had such tremendous possibilities and so on, there was nothing that would stop them and so on. They didn't have the idea. See, we have, I tell you what it really comes down to, the love, of course, in his essay, discuss Adam, the first Adam, the second. There are two aspects to man. And we have to bear in mind the possibilities of man, we have to bear in mind the limitations of man. But they were very optimistic in that sense, that they could conquer the world. They realized that there was certain optimism. True. They figured, well, in the course of time, we've made such tremendous progress, maybe we'll be able to conquer all of these problems as well. They don't have the idea of the worth of human life, because they don't have the idea that man is the creature of God, and that presumably he is of infinite value. They don't have that idea, so therefore they can expose infants, or they can take a person who perhaps is very sick and say, well, the best thing that person can do is to die. So they have euthanasia. They don't have the idea of truth. In fact, the great hero is Odysseus. Odysseus is a liar. Polyglot, a man of many devices. Tricky. This is their ideal. They don't have the idea of truth because we say, Hashem lekechem emet. God is a God of truth. And we have no alternative. We're not permitted to cheat, and so on and so forth. I remember when I first came here 50 years ago, I first came here, so there was a certain amount of tea in front of those amphibians. Maybe I shouldn't discuss this, you can't go on here. However, there was a certain amount. And quite naive as I was at that time, so it's a lot against the Torah. The idea of that's supposed to be seen, cool, and so on and so forth. I said, we have to do something about this. So the dean at that time said, typical national dean, said, well, if you think so, then you do something. I naively said, okay, I'll do something. I called for an assembly of all the students. And believe it or not, it was an assembly of students and so on and so forth. And we talked about the disguise and all the reasons why the students cheat and so on and so forth. And then there was a question group. So listen to this. It's a question. The question group. Somebody got up and he said, Dr. Feldman, suppose the professor doesn't have guts. Now, what I'm saying is, we have a Torah. We have a work that tells us this is right, this is wrong, this you must do, this you must not do, etc., etc. The Greeks did not have this Torah. They did not have such commandments. And hence, the hero was Odysseus, who was able to go beyond the norm, and deception was the rule as far as he was concerned. One other thing which I should mention, and that is that the Greeks did not have a system of compulsory education. Now, here's compulsory education, as you know, starts with Jews. It starts with the first century BC, first century CE, not that, but in any case, that you have with the Jews. The idea of compulsory education, at least for males, at least at elementary level. The Greeks said that you could afford it, then you went to school. Now, when they went to school, they had what they called a gymnasium. Now, this plays, of course, a role in this story of the Anacleus, because one of the things was Antiochus imposed on the Lyceum, Jason and Andreas, was the gymnasium. Now, gymnasium, according to you know, was a place not only for exercising, but also for learning. And I might say parenthetically that when I came to Yeshiva 50 years ago, there was no gymnasium. There was no gymnasium. I thought immediately that they were opposed on theoretical grounds. But the reason was they didn't have a joint. But anyway, eventually they got to that point too. Now, the gymnasium that I was opposed was a school for both mental and physical education. And one has to bear in mind that it was more like a kind of country club, in the sense that you had to, first of all, very expensive, so that only people who were rich could afford to go to school, send their children to school. And then they had the alumni, the people who went to the school, who joined together. It's really, it's sort of like the Harvard Club or the Yale Club or some of that kind of thing. And citizenship depended, in a sense, upon having a gymnastic education. And of course, people who were educated in the school participated in games, Olympic games, as you know. And Jews, of course, could not participate in these games if they understood something was involved, because if people exercised in noon, for example. But the people wanted to attend. I'm saying the people wanted to attend. You know, I've been working out for some time on Philo. Philo was a good Jew, whatever you may say about him. He would probably be a candidate for the Jewish Studies program. Now, the fact is that Philo did not have first-hand knowledge of the Torah. He knew the Torah only in Greek, Philo, in his writings, he had many of his writings, extolled the gymnasium with the idea of getting first-hand education, over the modestness from the gymnasium. He does not condemn it, but he praises it. In fact, he praises the author who studied most in the gymnasium, and that, of course, was Plato. Believe it or not, Philo, the good Jew, you know, as I say, Rusty, Aronides, Philo actually said that Philo is divine. That's the great Philo. Philo, Plato is divine. Now, Philo therefore favors the gymnasium. We know more about, this is an interesting fact. How do we know about the way in which the Greeks carried on exercises, the way they carried on sports? We know more about Greek sports from the writings of Philo than from any other source, because Philo himself must be in these places and must have engaged in some sports and so on and so forth. So that was the system. And the net result, of course, was that this was a whole way of life that they learned to belong to an alumni club and so on. You went from these schools. And the rich people wanted to do this, especially, let's say, in places like Alexandria. But apparently also under the leadership of the high priests, Jason and Menelaus in Jerusalem as well. I want to come to a conclusion. We may ask why the works of Philo and of the Hellenistic Jews are not mentioned by the rabbis. Why the rabbis don't mention three great philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Why don't they mention Philo, this great Jew who was certainly a philosopher, the first lawyer, probably the foundation of Western philosophy? We'll go back to him, whatever you might love to. At Plato. And Philo's work was not translated to Hebrew in the 16th century. Why? What do they have against him? Philo seemed to represent the synthesis, that is the word that we use in 19th century. Synthesis. Logomata, the synthesis of Jewish and secular studies. Now, why is it and that the works of Philo were not translated, not studied until the modern times, I believe, whereas in medieval Babylonia, Spain, the works of the Greeks were studied. Why the difference? So I'd like to suggest how Mr. Judaism, as represented here in Alexandria and Jerusalem in the 2nd century BCE, failed to become part of Jewish thinking. It failed to become part of Jewish living. Why? Because it sought to translate, to make Jewish concepts conform to the Greek concepts. What it tried to do was it looked at the Torah through the prism of Greek culture. The Rambam in the 12th century looked at Greek culture, Aristotle in particular, but he looked at Greek culture through the prism of the Torah. He did not, Philo read the Torah in Greek, and he read Plato in the original. Rambam read Aristotle in the translation and read the Torah in the original. I think that's the difference. We say God doesn't need the Ephesians from the old issue. God is the knowledge, the effect, as God said, the Greeks, the visual arts. But let them be taught within the precincts and parameters of the Spirit.
Thank you very much, Professor Feldman. This lecture was the first in the series of the Revival of the Harvard Lecture Series at Yeshiva, and will continue throughout the year. If you have any suggestions for lectures at any of your attached year, take place up here, please let us know. We need your input, lectures at YU.edu. If you have not yet signed a sign-up sheet, please do so. Thank you again, and have a happy night.